It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. We may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join me in a spirit of prayer. Let us give thanks for this amazing and miraculous gift of life, and let us work to complete it. Life comes to us in kit form, with some assembly required, but most of the pieces are blessed, far more than are not. Let us never doubt that we are a gift to this world, and let us pray that our world will be a blessing to us as well. So much is uncertain in life. How long we will live, how well we will live, the balance of our happy and our sad days, how we will love and be loved. So much is uncertain. But all the uncertainties take place within the larger miracle of life itself, the miracle of the fact that we are here at all. If the only prayer we ever uttered was simply thank you, it would be sufficient. Thank you to life, the universe, God, the unnameable mystery by whatever names we call it forth. Thank you. Let us give thanks for this amazing and miraculous gift of life, and let us show our gratitude by becoming a gift to ourselves and to others. For we are not only gifts, but also the bearers of gifts, and the world would not be as complete without us. So let us, above all else, remember to give thanks for the sheer gift of just being alive. Just being alive. Amen.
In 22 years, I've never preached on brokenness before. When I Googled it, I found that it is a very popular word among many Christian writers today. That surprised me. I love good and insightful thinking from anywhere, any religious tradition. But the things that I read on the word brokenness have an odd, almost a morbid undertone to them. And that was surprising. I want to read you the comments from just six different authors who were among the first dozen or so who came up on the Google search. You'll feel what I mean. One says, an unbroken person cannot be trusted. Renowned Catholic priest Henry Nouwen wrote that it's often difficult to believe that there's much to think, speak, or write about other than brokenness. Another author wrote that brokenness molds our character closer to the character of God than anything else. To experience defeat, disappointment, loss, the raw ingredients of brokenness, he says, moves us closer to being like God than victory and gain and fulfillment ever can. Now, this sounds like some of the teaching of some 12-step programs, And it's true that sometimes we have to hit the bottom before we're willing to wake up. At least some people are. But as a model for living our lives, another author says, God will only plant the seed of his life where the conviction of his spirit has brought brokenness. A fifth author says that every call to Christ is a call to suffering, and every call to suffering is a call to Christ. And a sixth says that worship starts with a broken heart. Now, I want to say that these voices are coming from a different world, but not the one most of us are living in or would want to live in. They're from the fringes of it. They're speaking from within one vehicle of insight and wholeness, the vehicle of one popular version of modern Christianity. And what I want to suggest this morning is that what's broken is not us, but that vehicle. I want to bring in a couple evangelical writers to say this, and then offer you some wisdom from a very different and probably unexpected source. A couple of weeks ago, I talked about a new book by Christine Wicker called The Fall of the Evangelical Nation, The Surprising Crisis Inside the Church. She was raised in the Evangelical Baptist Church. She came to Jesus at age 9. She later grew away from the church, but she kept a soft and very warm spot in her heart for evangelicalism. A couple years ago, a major publisher asked her to write a book about what great successes the megachurches were as spearheads of the evangelical movement. But after more than a year of research in the churches, talking to the leaders within the churches, they convinced her that she was writing the wrong book. She went back to her publisher and took another year to write instead about the unreported fact that evangelical churches and numbers are declining, have not kept up with population growth for the past 100 years, and that we've been duped into thinking they were strong because they manipulated the media so brilliantly. Now, that last piece, she's in an especially good place to write from because she was in the media and considers herself among the duped. She was the religion writer for the Dallas Morning News for 17 years. The reason for the decline in the evangelical churches, she says, and this is what makes it a bigger issue, is the same as the reason for the decline of almost all traditional churches. The fact that our world has changed. Our minds and hearts have changed. We no longer need the kind of God traditional religions often offer. And we need other important things that they seldom can offer. If you think about it, that's a revolutionary statement from a former evangelical. On Father's Day, this stands out to me more because it resonates with so many things I've read and everyone in religion has read about how 60 to 70% of the people who attend churches are always women. Men aren't interested in religion because it isn't hard-headed enough, it isn't solid enough, it isn't empirical, it isn't logical, it's just foolish poesy. I've read all these words. But I don't think it's that simple. I think, and Christine Wicker thinks also, that the problem is not so much men as parents. In the world today, parents believe, because they've learned in their own lives, that we need to be able to act, to adapt quickly, to think on our own, rather than blindly following an authoritative voice. We feel a visceral imperative to be more open and flexible than humans have been in the past. I think that as much as we've said about it, we have understated the kind of change it involves that we've just had a Democratic primary where the two choices were two classes of people who have never in our history been able to run for president of the United States. That's an immense step forward, that the two Democratic candidates were a woman and a black man. This is an openness that was not here 30 years ago, wasn't here 10 years ago. It's in families raising children, Christine Wicker thinks, where the real world and the world of religious dogma don't fit anymore. And you can test this with the way you've raised your own children and see if this feels true. Evangelical children, Christine says, are learning to obey authority, while other American children are learning to question authority. Right. They're learning to voice strong disagreement, to follow their own ideas. While evangelical parents may protect their children from growing up too fast, and there's a lot to be said for that, other American parents, both fathers and mothers, begin preparing their children to make decisions at earlier ages to grow up sooner. And there's a lot to be said for that, too. These deep-seated differences in what parents believe their children must have and in how children are being formed as a result are the greatest reason, Christine thinks, that Americans will never and can never return to the old-time religion. I think that's right. That fits with everything I've read and seen. The idea that a happy, self-reliant person with adequate self-esteem is more likely to be a moral person and a good citizen, that idea has replaced the older Christian image of humans as sinful, broken creatures in need of outside salvation. What was once called sin is now considered sickness. We've all lived through this vocabulary change. The vocabulary of a judgmental theology has been taken over by the vocabulary of a psychology that's trying to make us more whole. So health rather than holiness is the modern parent's goal, and I'd say most of our goals. And I want to say that's a good thing. It seems that a new way of judging what's moral and what's not moral is coming into being. And it means, this is Christine still, saying it means that people don't feel the same need for the same kind of God that traditional religion supplies. This kind of thinking makes our children flexible, thinking, reasoning, searching, and very unorthodox people. It leads to deeper, more aware, nuanced, and integrated kids. This state of hopeful wholeness was once called salvation in some circles. Today we just tend to call it health. So one point is that traditional religion has lost its roots in and lost the ability to prepare us for the world outside the walls of the church, and many fathers and mothers don't trust it to prepare their kids for the future anymore. That's a powerful statement, and I think Christine's probably right. But let's hear from one more evangelical, one who's writing from inside the faith rather than having left it, as Christine Wicker did. Alan Jacobs is a professor of English at Wheaton College, and he wrote this for the Wall Street Journal just over a week ago. Some of you may have read it. Here's part of what he wrote. If there's one agreed-upon point in the current war of words about religion, it is that religion is a very powerful force. Is it, though? I have my doubts. And they begin with personal experience. I am, by most measures, a pretty deeply committed Christian. I'm quite active in my church. I teach at a Christian college. I have written extensively in support of Christian ideas and belief. Yet when I ask myself how much of what I do and think is driven by my religious beliefs, the honest answer is not so much. the books I read, the food I eat, the music I listen to, my hobbies and interests, the thoughts that occupy my mind throughout the greater part of every day, these are, if truth be told, far less indebted to my Christianity than to my status as a middle-aged, middle-class American man. They're driven by culture, not religion. When people say that they are acting out of religious conviction, I tend to be skeptical. I tend to wonder whether they're not acting as I usually do, out of motives and impulses over which I could paint a thin religious veneer, but which are really not religious at all. That's quite a candid statement from a man. Remember, this man is not a Christ-hating savage. He teaches at Wheaton College in Illinois. That's the alma mater of Billy Graham, which has never been known as a bastion of liberal thought. I don't know whether he still teaches there, but, but he did a week and a half ago. So one former evangelical author says the membership in the churches is declining and they cannot convert enough new people to keep from shrinking because they are too far out of touch with the world we really live in and we prefer the world we really live in. And a current professor at the flagship of many evangelical colleges, Wheaton College, says that even within the religion, the truth is that religion has very little to do with what we think, read, feel, or do. That's quite a statement. This is a measure of a religion that has become a broken vehicle in many ways for helping us find more meaning and purpose in life. Its wheels have come off. And these are testimonies from people within the movement. So, I began with the idea of brokenness, which is this concept deeply embedded in a lot of modern religious thinking in our culture. I gave you some of the research by a former evangelical who now is an outsider to that worldview, says that even the churches know that they're dying and that they will not regain the power to be persuasive because the world has changed too much. Then Alan Jacobs, teaching at one of the flagship evangelical colleges, says that even as a believer, he has to admit that his religious beliefs actually play almost no role in how he thinks, feels, or lives. I think there's good evidence that many of the loudest religious voices telling us we're broken and that we need their special salvation are, in fact, themselves broken and failing as useful vehicles for our most important hopes, fears, and yearnings. What a mess that sounds like we're in. The dominant religious flavor of our culture, we've been told, its wheels coming off. Is there any hope for us? Doesn't this mean we're completely broken and really need to be falling on our knees and begging for forgiveness and salvation from somewhere? What if instead we were to seek out some wise figures who live in this real world, who are at home in it, and who are also asking questions about life, meaning, and purpose? What if we looked to a different vehicle addressing the same kinds of questions? How different would their advice sound than these messages insisting that God only cares for broken souls? It just so happens, you'll be glad to know, that we have some of these voices among us. So I want to read you a few things from their wisdom. It's a very different kind of wisdom. It'll feel different. And what's most important about it is that it comes from a different center. And it's that center that I want to try to make clear this morning. Remember, the question guiding us this morning is the question of brokenness. Are we broken? Is brokenness really a healthy and useful lens through which we can look at our lives? Or is there a way of understanding ourselves that is not broken and that's better for us? Some of you have already heard these voices because they are four of our own high school students who presented short homilies during their youth service here last Sunday. If you missed it, you missed something very special. I'd like you to listen to a few insights from four teenagers who live in the modern world, are creatures of that world, and who believe that what they've learned in this church, and I hope could learn in any good liberal church, is that their questions and feelings matter, that they can trust their minds, and they can find their own healthy and whole path through life if they choose to. Now, I am not asking you to listen to these kids' words with a polite, pleasant, patronizing attitude. I don't want you to think, oh, how sweet, they've put a few words together around beliefs. Isn't that special? We'll pat them on the head. No. I want you to be very hard-edged here and listen to it the same way you would listen to wisdom being offered to you from anywhere. I want you to ask, is this better than the lines about brokenness? Does this feel like it's coming from a more whole and healthy place than these other words? Don't give them a break, but give them a chance. Josh Mays is one of our students. And he says, as our lives change, we lose and discover things about ourselves. We change from what we were to what we are to what we could be. Sometimes we also find friendships we thought we could never have without even trying. In my short 16 years, I've moved 10 times. And every time I seem to find these wonderful and amazing people without even looking. They seem to pop out of nowhere and change my life. That, I think, is the greatest thing anyone could find. The love and joy of friends. He doesn't sound broken. Listen to the trust in this boy. He's found a way to back off and see life as a moving picture. He isn't trying to cling to any kind of a dogmatic truth. He already knows that life is about change. He isn't looking for water wings. He's looking for swimming lessons. And he's swimming pretty well. Natalie Houchins reflected on a Rolling Stones song from her parents' generation. This is after assuring the congregation that, yes, she really does know who the Rolling Stones were. And she reflected on their song about how you can't always get what you want, but if you try sometimes, you can get what you need. She says, no matter how much we want something or how much we think we must have something or how hard we try to get it, sometimes the universe just won't let it happen. But if you try sometimes, if you try new things and expand your world, you can get what you need, even if you hadn't known that you needed it. She told a story to illustrate this about a time that she was digging through the family couch looking for loose change to buy candy at the movies. I imagine everyone here can remember doing that. She didn't find enough change to get the candy. That's what she wanted. But she did find something without which many teenagers might not be able to survive for even one day. She found her cell phone. She didn't even know she'd lost it. So she turned this into a message about life. The world, she said, is like a big couch, littered with all sorts of random objects and waiting for us to dig around in it. Maybe we'll find what we want. Maybe we'll find what we haven't been looking for, but need more than we thought. Nevertheless, the choice is ours whether or not to look in the first place. And she thinks we should be out there digging around in the couch of life. She doesn't sound broken. Our third student, Shane Rice, thought about the whole idea of gaining experiences. Shane gets very philosophical on us. He said that unless you live under a rock, you're experiencing things every day. And then he said that, well, even if you do live under a rock, you're probably experiencing things too, like pain and boredom. But it's not like you can go to the movie store and pick out which experiences you want and skip the bad ones. If you want to have really valuable experiences, you have to be patient, because not all experiences are either valuable or pleasant. And when the really valuable experiences do happen, it may not be when or where you expect. Like John Lennon said, life is what happens while you're making other plans. Now, does this sound like a modern teenager or an ancient sage? And then Sierra Page Tothero talked about happiness. She's already learned that you can't buy it, not even with money from the couch. You have to know where to find it, she says, and this is the tricky part. How can we get it? You can try as hard as you possibly can to reach this happiness and still not get it. You can't control it. You can alter your mood and surround yourselves with things that supposedly make you happy, and some days the happiness just won't come. So she decides that maybe happiness is more complex than we've thought. Maybe it has to include the sadness, the fear, the satisfaction, the contentment, the surprise, and the regrets. Like Natalie, she invents an analogy for us. She says, maybe happiness is like white light. White light is made up of all the colors, and if one color were missing, it wouldn't be pure white. Just like if one of our experiences was missing, or if an emotion were suppressed for a lifetime, it wouldn't be as full, as complete a life. It isn't about pretending that we can only have happy, fun experiences. I'd say that's not the real world, that's Disney World. She says, at age 15, that in our real world pursuit of happiness, we're gathering experiences that at the end of our lifetime might just combine and finally give us our greatest happiness, the most full and satisfying life, just the way all the different colors combine to make pure white light. She doesn't sound broken either. These young people are not finished growing, but they're not broken. They see the good and the bad as inherent parts of life. They see happiness as living in a way that can let them integrate all of their experiences and weave them into a character with depth and nuance. And they have the confidence that they will be able to do this. The truth is, we're completely at home in the real world. Whatever is sacred is here, which means that whatever is sacred is already within us too. We're linked with all the other life on Earth. We're part of the world all the way down. All of our ecological awareness tells us this. And our salvation, our wholeness, has to be rooted deeply in the real world around us, down at its most profound and life-giving parts, all the way down. It doesn't come from another world. It comes from being deeply, fully integrated into this world, into our life that's grown from this world, and into the gifts that will extend from our life to make the world better for the future. That's the voice you hear coming from our own high school students.
not because they were taught a doctrine or a dogma, but because they were taught that they must think, they must interact with the world, and that it can mostly be trusted, and so can their own powers of reasoning and meaning-making. We're saved today not by dogmas or orthodoxies, but by an empowered imagination and our ability to imagine our own most fulfilling paths through life. And we're hearing from 15 and 16-year-olds the confidence that they can do it, and already the ability to see life more whole and more clearly than many traditional religions seem to be offering people. That's a revolution. We're not broken. We're unfinished. We don't need to be made holy. We need to be made whole. And that changes everything. We can trust life. We can trust ourselves. We can trust in the best of human relationships. And we can weather the worst of them. And it's okay when we occasionally fail, because failing is part of living, and it's one of the experiences that will make us richer. Now let me sum this up in the words of some local sages. As we go digging through the big couch of life, we can find things we want and things we need as we change from what we were to what we are to what we could be. If we want to have really valuable experiences, we have to be patient, because not all experiences are either valuable or pleasant. And when the really valuable experiences do happen, it may not be when or where we expected. But don't be afraid of the wide range of life's experiences. And don't be afraid of failing, because in the end, they can all go together and blend together like rays of different colored lights to create a kind of white light so complete that we can call it by its true name, its ancient religious names, illumination and enlightenment. That isn't broken. It's whole. It's blessed, and it is very, very good.